Hello and welcome to Culture with me, Robert Bound. Where on today's show we're asking, how do you start a collection? We're mostly talking art, but we'll touch on design too. And we're asking, because it's such a thing, whether you collect for love or money, how do you start? Who do you ask? How do you go about it? And of course, at the moment, people are dismayed by art bought not to hang above the fireplace, but to be kept in a huge Swiss freeport until they find an even more biddable buyer in a few years' time. We'll speak to a London art advisor. We'll speak to our panellists from the just past Monocle Conference in Vienna, in which we asked about collecting. And we'll speak to someone that sells and collects too, both sides of the coin. How do you start a collection? It's all to come on today's episode of Culture with me, Robert Bound. Do stay tuned. First of all, we're going to speak to Kathleen Fox-Davies, an art advisor and a private dealer here in London. Kathleen has a string of clients, some old hands in the art world, some bright young things that need a word to the wise. How do you start a conversation in a big, scary contemporary gallery? How do you pass the test of being allowed into the inner sanctum? How do you ask how much something is, even? Kathleen will tell us all.
My job exists, really, to grant access. Some galleries can be incredibly intimidating to walk in. Even after 12 years in the industry, walking into a gallery and asking for a price list or a question and going through the process of being assessed by the reception staff and then the call up to the director if you are deemed important enough to actually have a real conversation, or if you'll just be given the canned answers that the whoever sitting at the front desk is allowed to give. So I help break down the walls and allow access. And also with my role, I have direct access to artists as well, which offers a unique opportunity to, where appropriate, bypass some of the galleries and allow clients to almost become patrons in their own right with relationships with an artist directly.
So it's an interesting thing. There are many hoops to jump through, and whether you're buying straight from a gallery or whether you're going through you presumably, as much as you offer a bridge between a potential buyer, a client, and a gallery or an artist, you as well have to, there is a pecking order presumably in your world as well, and you kind of will make an assessment of someone that wants to buy something. Presumably everyone says they get the tube. And no one turns up in their Bentley. I mean, yes. Presumably there is an idea of stealth wealth about all this and about what we're going to put, in inverted commas, the right reason. Because today we're going to talk about collecting for investment as well as talking collecting for love. On which side of that heady divide do you come down, Kathy?
I come down right in the middle, actually, because I work with clients that they might have started from all different places as far as where their motivations are. But at the end, when you're parting with your hard-earned money to buy this thing that has created this idea of passion in you that you must have, because it is a moment of a transaction of commerce, people want to know that what they're purchasing at least is going to hold its value, that it's not going to be the car that you drive off the lot that decreases in price the right minute you hit the first street light. So the people that I tend to work with, my clients, they tend to be quite self-aware. They want to be educated about the artist, whether it be the movement, what type of medium. They want to be educated about what they're doing. So they're not just coming in off the street going, I love it, I'll take five.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Yeah. You make an important distinction there as well of people who have been successful in their professional life, most probably have some money to spend and don't want to be sold a pup, right?
Exactly.
They need to know that whatever they're buying will at least hold its value.
Exactly.
There are also sort of bragging rights. And I don't mean I've got a Warhol and you haven't, kind of bragging rights.
There's that too.
There is that too. people might take that as read though, but the idea of having the right sort of period or the right edition of screen prints, of silk screens, that sort of thing. Do people come to you for knowledge? Do they want to kind of show off some of their knowledge and kind of have more of a meeting of equals with
you? It's absolutely both. I love having interaction with the clients because a lot of it is being able to show what they know and what they've learned. The internet is a wonderful resource, but it does not top decades of industry knowledge, of research, of knowledge of the historical periods and the mediums and conditions of the actual pieces as individuals. I personally work in photography and limited editions on paper. So that idea that there are multiples out there is often both appealing and a drawback to certain clients, depending on what their interests are. But when you use Google, you are, all of a sudden, you can find 5 Warhols for sale. They're all at vastly different prices, but it's the same stock image that's being used to advertise it online. So how do you know if you're being sold a dud that has watermarks and it's been eaten away at the edges and folded in half, or if it's in pristine condition? And that's where you really have to trust your advisor, your dealer, and build those relationships so that you know that what you're getting is the very best value for the right kind of Warhol, really.
Do you hold people's hand and go into a gallery? Or how does it work? Or is this all kind of slightly done behind closed doors? It's all done on JPEGs and telephone calls.
It's done all of the above, actually.
Yeah.
With new clients, I always like to take them in because I think that you can't judge where their tastes are and what they're really looking for until you see their actual emotional reaction standing in front of a piece. And it might be complete disgust. It's not for them, or they might fall in love with it. I think with art, it's tactile. You have an emotional experience when standing in front of it if it's the right piece for you. So you have to actually go in and have that interaction. We live in a modern age where so much is done via JPEGs, telephone calls, emails, but nothing replaces that actual encounter that you have with the piece. And that's the part of art collecting that becomes addictive. It's
yeah,
that
well,
sense of discovery.
This,
yes.
We've talked about this before, I know, Kathleen, about the art collection as an addiction, or all sorts of collecting as an addiction. Now, you have an idea of that. You have a sort of deep-seated, sort of scientific, or certainly it is a human thing, an inbuilt human thing that we want to keep things.
It's innately
things,
part of
stuff,
our,
right?
Exactly. It's innately part of our humanity that we want to surround ourselves with belonging that we've accumulated. It's what helps define us, our personalities, our identity, our social standing. I mean, it's the entire reason the British Museum exists.
Yeah.
Sir Hans Sloane
yeah.
had the largest cabinet of curiosities at that moment, possibly ever in time. He had 71,000 objects, which is the definition of an extreme hoarder or an
They'd
intellectual genius.
They'd make a TV
genius.
Program about him, though, wouldn't they?
Yeah.
They'd get him to clear out his attic or something.
Oh, exactly. It's incredible. But that his entire collection of things he found interesting that he had to have, that he surrounded himself with, that helped define who he was to his peers, became one of the most important British institutions of fine art and
of looted booty.
Exactly.
There is, of course, that idea of bragging rights, of having people around for dinner and just taking them into the Warhol room. But there is also that idea of presumably people coming up like puppy dogs and really wanting to, loving something and wanting to know about something. How open are people about the money they've got to spend, their ignorance in this field, and not knowing the ropes? Because it's tough, as we say, if someone's a successful person, it's tough for them to sort of give themselves up suddenly and jump into your arms, isn't it?
Well, it's articulating a vulnerability of not knowing something, which is we never love. But in order for me to do my job well and for me to have an honest relationship with my client and be able to act as their advocate, I do need to know things like what their intended budget is, what I always ask at the beginning, what do you want?
Yeah.
And what do you hope to achieve from getting this?
And so, people presumably don't come to you with a blank canvas, do
no.
they? They go, God, I've seen this thing. I went to Frieze and I saw this and I loved it, but I couldn't afford it. What is there anything else like this?
Exactly.
Yeah.
I've got a client that quite recently came to me because they're looking to specifically fill an empty wall, which is the most basic of needs. And that's actually...
What do you think about that?
I love it because that's where it starts.
You've got a blank canvas.
That's
there,
where it starts.
You?
It's literally a blank canvas and it's an opportunity to start something. I always say that none of my clients have ever started out saying, I want to become a collector. That's my goal. The collections start having you as you jump into this world of beautiful objects. And it's just a desire to surround yourself with something beautiful that you'll enjoy. And finding pleasure in that, it leads to the next and the next. So oftentimes it'll be the most basic, almost crass, I need a blue picture to match the blue rug and the blue couch. That turns into a really amazing relationship.
Miami too.
Exactly. Decades long of collecting.
What about fashion, Kathleen? I mean, you can see these things, even at kind of blue chip art fairs like the Friezes and Art Basels of this world, we see paintings that are kind of influenced by the internet. You see cat art, you know. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that seems to have filtered down through BuzzFeed, you know, quite obviously.
Mm.
And a lot of
very
things
kitsch.
That might, there's a lot of that sort of kitsch stuff. Where do you stand with that, or how do you advise people on things like that? Do you have to tell them to take the long view unless they really must have something?
Well, at the end of the day, you have to love what you're purchasing. And if you love a picture of a cat jumping into avoid, then that's what you love. It's not my taste. It might not be your taste. It's difficult when you're working at the top end of the market and the prices that are being asked are sometimes eye-watering. The pieces, 9 times out of 10, are not going to hold their value. and they definitely will not increase in value. So it is hard when you have very, very bright, educated individuals who insist on purchasing something.
And you have to keep on making the really face?
Yeah, it is a bit difficult because art is, unfortunately, it is viewed as an investment, as an asset. And it's not a great asset because it's incredibly unpredictable.
Yeah.
The value of a piece of art at the end of the day is only defined by what the next person is willing to pay for it, no matter what a gallery or the market says that the current value of it is that you give to your insurance company. And that's the end of it. So you have to have something that you're going to hang on your wall and that's going to bring you joy, no matter what happens with the financial markets or the art markets around the world and how they crumble under our feet or boom.
And just finally then, we've talked about collecting for love, we've talked about collecting for investment. What about the artists in all this? You obviously work with estates as well as living artists, I guess. What about collectors and artists? Artists presumably love the fact that collectors exist. In fact, I know they do. But do the collectors feel they have to meet the artists? Do they need to know the life story? Do they need to know what they had for breakfast last Tuesday? Because there's a lot of... I wonder how that relationship works for you.
I have clients that their specific motivations are the idea of patronage. It didn't start out that way, but that's where it went, where they like that sense of discovery of finding a new young artist and buying deeply in each series as it comes out. It becomes an obsession. And it's not so much an obsession of what the artist is having for breakfast, but I do think that...
There's a bit of... You sort of fall in love with people.
You fall in love with people. Yeah. And it's quite difficult, actually, because if you are an artist of a lovely disposition, it makes everyone's job so much easier. But there are often artists that we actively keep away from clients because it will dissuade them from ever wanting a piece on the wall after having an interaction
with
them.
I wish this was the kind of show we name names.
It makes it very fun and the challenge of it. But I think the personal relationships with artists can be difficult because it does change how you view the piece.
Yeah.
So many artists, they have their own motivations in creating the work, but then an individual will stand in front of it and bring their own experiences and knowledge and opinions to it. And I think sometimes it's that interaction that makes the art powerful, no matter what the artist says it was meant to be and how they want to be defined. And sometimes if there's a conflicting idea there, it can destroy your entire notion of the piece and you won't love it anymore. And that can be quite sad when you do see something like that happen. But you do have a lot of clients that take specific interest in supporting young artists and their careers and seeing them grow. And that's part of the fun of it. But that's also the idea of the hunt and almost the trophy hunting, because you're trying to find the next great thing and be the first one in and then see it grow. And it's quite satisfying and gratifying when that something like that happens.
Yeah, exactly. You stuff the head and you put it on your hunting lodge wall.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. That was Kathleen Fox-Davis, who's an art advisor here in London. Up next, Vienna.
See that man sitting opposite you on the subway, lost in another world? Or that smart woman scribbling notes while having her flat white? Well, here's what links them. They're both listening to Monocle 24 via our free radio app that simply and seamlessly lets you tune in live or download shows for later enjoyment. Just think, you too could be settling back enjoying cultural nourishment in the form of the Monocle Arts Review, being briefed on the world of business with the entrepreneurs, or just enjoying great music with the sessions at Midori House. Come on, download the Monocle 24 app today, stick on your headphones, and have informed fun on the go. Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound, and today we're asking the question, how do you start a collection? This weekend, the Monocle team temporarily relocated to Vienna for this year's Quality of Life conference. One of the panels happening that day, and inspiration for this show no less, was all about collecting. I was joined on stage by the artist Martin Gutmann, gallery owner Clemens Gunzer, and director of Vienna Design Week, Lily Holland.
Martin, I wanted to ask you, there seems to be a shift, and I guess that's part of what this panel wants to touch on, is that we go around the world, we're invited to lots of amazing art fairs. By day 2-3, they're open to the public, and you see thousands and thousands of people wanting to go to the Frieze Art Fair, for example, in London. Regular members of the public who are going there maybe with an eye to buying a piece, but certainly intrigued by the world of collecting. it's not a, you know, it's not, you can't call it a democratizing of the world of collecting, but it's opened up in a really kind of fascinating way. For you as an artist, is that an appealing thing that suddenly the person who's buying you, maybe they're not somebody running a big private collection, maybe they're not somebody in a museum, but there's somebody who's got a bit of money and thinks they want some expression of who they are and what they believe in. Do you enjoy this fact that the person who may ring your doorbell or go and see your agent is perhaps somebody you've never met before and whose tastes you don't know and they're a bit more random who comes to you?
I don't care that much about the class where the collector comes from or their profession. From my point of view, I would like the feeling that the person engages in the work. And that is, as much as the art world grew, the proportion of people who really engage did not grow proportionally. That's what really concerns me, to deal with people who really put the time and effort to engage in the work, to have an aesthetic experience.
Are you ever reluctant to let a piece go? Does somebody come to you and say, I want this piece, I've got the money? Do you ever feel like saying, actually, I think it's sold, I don't think you can have that piece?
I don't sell my own work, that's what galleries are for.
But would you like your gallery to be in that role of being, you say you care where the work goes, you like them to be doing that job for you?
Well, of course, if there's a great collection, I would like my work to be part of it. But when you cut off the top part and the great museums, no, to repeat, it's not just that I don't care about the class and profession of the collectors, but I kind of resent the fact that art lends itself to construction of snobbish attitude. I think that art is there to have an aesthetic experience. An aesthetic experience is not something that you necessarily have to go to university to be able to do. It's really a lot about understanding that you're confronting with an artwork and you really have to put yourself, to open yourself up and to really try to think about yourself being presented with something that somebody else did with certain intentions and really try to understand what these intentions are. It's a communicative thing to make art, and people who just shut the shutters before they even get there, I have problems with that.
What is the difference between collecting and buying, I wonder? Whether someone walks into your gallery, Clemens, and you can tell that you're dealing with what you might call a collector. I'm not talking about how nicely cut their suit is, but you're talking about someone that you feel has picked up the vibe. What's the difference between someone that simply buys something and someone that's a collector, rather than just the amount of stuff they've got on their walls?
It's the questions they ask you. If they immediately ask you, do you think it's going to rise in value, then you know that they're not decorating their walls.
But yeah.
So it's basically the questions they ask you and why they even come to your place and beforehand and what they want. Do they want young stuff? Do they want mid-career artists? Do they want blue chip art?
To answer it for the design world, if you want to invest in design as an investment, the people buy the same stuff. I mean, it's the same in art to a certain extent too, but if you buy early Jean Prouvé or George Nakashima, that has a price that will be more or less stable, but it will never be an exciting collection that is different from other collections. I think building up a collection is exciting when you can add a certain point and also maybe even something such as a personal handwriting or also enabling people. I mean, what we do at Vienna Design Week is we commission pieces that otherwise would not come into being.
So this brings us on to the idea of where do you actually put collections? Because it's one of those things, it's both an aesthetic challenge and hopefully an aesthetic pleasure, but also it's almost a moral question. We sometimes think if you have a huge art collection and you keep it in a Freeport in Geneva, that's considered not very groovy. You should really be buying stuff that you want to have. You want to scatter your home or homes with this stuff. So Clemens, maybe tell us first of all, obviously you're buying stuff to sell. Sometimes you're having to kill your darlings and buy stuff to sell to other people. But mostly, where does your personal collection sit and where does the gallery stuff sit?
They all mix. So there's no gallery collection.
Business and pleasure.
No. It's all pleasure. No, so most of the stuff is in my house, but I do change a lot. I have a warehouse nearby, and I can basically carry the stuff from the warehouse to my house and then swap the paintings.
Martin, as someone who's creating work, you know, I often wonder whether artists have an eye on where it is going to end up in someone's home, because you can create pieces which are so vast and complicated, you realize nobody actually would be able to have it in their home. Is there a kind of a tug of domesticity that actually comes into your mind every now when you create a piece thinking, actually, that would be bigger than someone's house, or that you couldn't get through the front door? Do you have to think about the realities of someone owning a piece and taking it into their lives?
Oh, totally. It happened to me. Michael and I are doing a lot of portraits, and many times the people that we portray tell us, please don't make it more than 2.5 meters wide, and things like that. We just don't have the wall for it, and things like that. It happens very often.
And you don't mind that. So it's interesting, there's a crossover here with the design world, because, you know, that is a challenge for some artists to understand that people are thinking, it will look good on that wall. What size is it? You're constrained a bit by people's, their homes and by the sizes of their walls.
I like those constraints. This is really part of the concept. You know, when you make a portrait, you really open yourself up to outside influences, because the idea of a good portrait is that you see another presence in the work. It's not just the artist projecting. There's another presence that comes out of the work. So from the very concept of portrait, you have to deal with something else except you, your own decision. And I like that very much, provided that it's done straightforwardly and at an early date, you know, not to kind of say, come to think of it, why don't you make it 0.5 meter small?
Come to think of it, it's going in the bathroom. Yeah. Could you make it half the size, please?
That was a snippet from our panel on collecting that took place over the weekend at the Monocle Quality of Life Conference in Vienna. Thanks to my panellists, Martin Gutmann, Clemens Gunzer and Lily Hollein. Look out for our films from the conference coming to monocle.com later on this week. Marine Tongi is a gallerist turned art agent who does a little bit of art dealing too. Last year, she launched her company MT Art, which represents a new generation of international young artists, creating shows for them around the globe and gaining the attention of potential buyers. But Marine doesn't believe in just investing in one piece of art. She thinks that we should be investing in the artist. Culture producer Holly went to meet Marine in the apartment of one of her artists, Anna Fafilou.
I feel like for our field, rather than any other field, so like if you look at music, if you look at acting, if you look at even publishing actually, a lot of the time we look at talents as a person. Whereas I feel like obviously in the art world, having art objects, you're looking always at the art objects, but I feel you forget a lot about who is behind the art objects. So rather than investing continuously in the latest trendy body of work, I want to change the trend to investing in the artists themselves. So actually the growth and the investment last longer because you're investing into a person. But also I think if it kind of there's a deeper meaning because you're going into vision more than you're going into a temporary lucky body of work.
Who's approaching you to invest in these artists? Is it people who have large collections and want to further them, or are you advising people who haven't collected art before but are maybe looking to?
So I actually think what's very interesting is the two of them. So I also have the big collectors. I found our approach very refreshing because rather than having the artist kept away and only just looking at the art, was really nice that they get to know the artist as well, and they kind of they get to follow the vision and the thinking of an artist. So they really enjoy that because they feel they're part of a generation for that being. And then I think that the number two is I'm friends with a lot of tech people, and I think that's a new market who they're just not interested in the glass of champagne and the fluffiness of that field really. They kind of they come on trainers and they want things that technically are innovative and strong core meaning, so good narratives of the works as well.
It's all quite sort of financially led, and obviously it's investing, so people are doing this with money on the mind, but do you think that sort of takes away the romance of collecting, or are people still doing it for the love of art?
I personally was more romantic than I was pragmatic when I started, and I think all good things should be backed up by money, because I think it kind of makes it more stable and sustainable over the long term. So I think there's nothing wrong when someone has a very strong meaning behind the work and is extremely talented to actually say that's someone that we would look up to as part of that generation over the long term. So I do think it takes off the romanticism. I think quite the opposite, because by having a lot of people backing up this artist, it kind of removes the elitism of just a few deciding on their careers. Instead, you have a lot of people deciding about why they're important and why they matter.
If you had to give somebody tips for how to start an art collection, what would you say?
Curiosity is the best way. So read, watch movies, listen to people, go to exhibitions, ask questions. I think actually ask questions is probably the key factor, and ask very silly questions. You know, what are your inspirations? What does this mean for you? How did you get there? Was that from a book? Or is there like another artist inspiring you? You know, like I always feel like a kid whenever I come to a studio of my artist, because I'm a kid that's being explained how their vision was built up. So just ask very silly questions. I will ignore a lot of the gossipy, trendy thing. I just don't think that's very relevant. I think that's a lot of noise. And I will concentrate about what's your set of belief and values. What do you actually really like? And often in music, in movies, in books, in art, there's a lot of connections in what you like. So if there's a creative field you're already strong enough, actually it's likely to join parallel into what you would like in the other creative field.
You've got a show coming up in New York during Freeze Week. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yes, so all our shows, like the one coming up in New York, they're kind of built against, I think, the major art fairs, in the sense that we take big spaces, but we go against a shop way of displaying works. So this show is opening on the 6th and then running through Freeze Week.
And we have one of your artists sitting right over here, Anna. Anna, you're actually sitting right next to the piece of art that you're taking with you.
I'm creating a site-specific installation where basically the audience will be able to walk through. The concept behind it, I'm taking basically objects and memories from the past, and I'm kind of playing with their identity. And I'm trying only to keep the shape, like the distorted memory, what is left from that thing from the past.
Do you think that there should be more of this sort of artist management than there is now?
Definitely, because, you know, the thing is, if you want to be an artist, you have to have the time to work on your art. And I think an artist shouldn't be worried about things like press or collectors, or how do I promote myself now? How am I supposed to do this? You know, the business part. I like this idea of a partnership, because this, at least for me, it gives me more time to work on my concepts, on how to make this become something. And then I have Marine, who's gonna be there to support me and say, oh, Anna, I think this could work, things that I wouldn't be able to do myself.
That was Marine Tongi, CEO of MT Art, and one of her artists, Anna Fafiliou. Marine's artist showing in Brussels this week and in New York from the 6th to the 10th of May. So there we have it. How do you start a collection? By, you know, liking things, loving things, requiring the company of charming artifacts around you. You have to do it for love, even if you do want to keep an eye on the bottom line. How do you start a collection? With confidence, but with cartoonish hearts in your eyes. That brings us to the end of today's show. You've been listening to Culture, where my very own producer was our very own Picasso in the Attic, Holly Fisher. Join me again at the very same time next week. But for the time being, I've been Robert Bound, and thank you very much for tuning in.